طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح. طفلة تمتطي.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, which features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This is John Roberts. This morning we feature an incisive presentation by Northwestern University anthropologist Jessica Winiger, who takes a long, critical look at the minefield of Middle East studies in academia today through her new book, Anthropology's Politics, Disciplining the Middle East. This talk, based on a book co-authored with Laura Deeb, examines the complex pressures that shape how U.S. scholars research and teach about the Middle East. Using ethnographic and archival research on Middle East anthropology as a lens into the broader politics of the U.S. Academy, it reveals the persistent consequences of ongoing racism, sexism, Islamophobia, and anti-Palestinian prejudice within the academy. Jessica Winiger gave this talk at Tufts University and is introduced by Tufts anthropology professor Amal Bishara.
Professor Winiger is the Harold H. and Virginia Anderson Chair, an associate professor of anthropology at Northwestern, and she's also the director of graduate studies, which is great. Again, I mean, I think that this kind of a talk is so important because, especially for students, to understand sort of how academia works is actually a big project and one that needs some work to unpack, right? And so I think that this work is part of that. And it's interesting to see that obviously you do that both through service in your own university, but also through the research that you'll be presenting today. Professor Winiger is the author of numerous articles on arts and culture in the Middle East. I have taught Professor Winiger's amazing book, Creative Reckonings, The Politics of Art and Culture in Contemporary Egypt, which came out in 2006 and won the Albert Hourani Award for Best Book in Middle East Studies and the Arnold Rubin Award for Best Book on African Arts. And today we're here to talk about her newer book, co-authored with Laura Deeb, Anthropology's Politics, Discipline and Region. Sorry, Anthropology's Politics, Disciplining the Middle East, and which is brand new, Stanford 2015. In addition to the academic writing, Jessica Winiger is also a prolific public intellectual. She's currently actually doing an op-ed project, Public Voices Fellowship, that has her especially working on op-eds, and that's a tremendous contribution to us all as well. She's written about the Arab Spring in academic and slightly less academic places as well, including a piece on the privilege of revolution, gender, class, space, and affect in Egypt, which I've taught in this very room, and it helps us think critically about gender and field work, especially in times of crisis and political turmoil. In addition to all the writing, she has also she's also done a lot of artistic work and curation, including she was the virtual gallery curator for Art at East for 5 years. So without further ado, I want to welcome Jessica Winiger, and thanks again for being here, all of you. Thank you so much. Can you all hear me? Okay, great. Thank you so much, Amal Bishara, for inviting me here today. I also have been looking forward to coming here and speaking with you about my new work, and really, thank you for that introduction. I'd like to obviously thank the Middle Eastern Studies Program, the Anthropology Department, and the Women and Gender Studies? Women and Gender and Sexuality Studies Program at Tufts for having me here today. And thank you for coming on such a beautiful night when you could probably just be outside having fun. So I really appreciate that you came here. And I'm reading you my paper from next to this open window with this breeze coming in. It's like really idyllic. So today I'll be presenting part of a book that I've co-authored, Laura Deeb, that's just come out with Stanford. As Amal mentioned, the title is Anthropology's Politics, Disciplining the Middle East. And there's train tracks. So our book is based on ethnographic and archival research, and it's a critical analysis of how national and international political, economic, and social trends since World War II have intimately shaped our day-to-day lives as academics, with huge consequences for teaching and scholarship. So if you are a faculty member in the room, this is very pertinent to understanding your socialization as an academic, and if you're a student in the room, this is really pertinent to understanding how your faculty came to teach the things they teach and how they came to not teach the things they're not teaching you. The political, economic, and social trends in the U.S. since World War II have produced politics of various scales that all of us deal with every day in our work in colleges and universities, no matter our discipline, our foci, or our backgrounds. We therefore need to excavate these politics from personal experience in order to see their broader patterns in the academy and understand their larger impact on our mission to research and to educate. Today I'll begin by giving you an overview of the concerns and framework of the book and discussing the utility of both Middle East studies and anthropology for tracking academic practice at the intersection of national and international politics. And I apologize for my voice. I'm going to get the water ready. Then I'm going to delve into one example that features prominently in the book because it reveals what is at stake as knowledge production and institutions of higher learning become increasingly corporatized and increasingly intertwined with the state's military projects. And this is the case of researching and teaching about Israel-Palestine. This case highlights in really clear form several of the book's arguments, which I'll tell you about now, but you can also still buy the book. First argument, politicized pressures on academics from a range of sources have affected careers in terms of access to the discipline and regional field sites, relationships with advisors, experiences on the job market, success in obtaining research funding, and ability to teach or give public lectures, such as this one, without fearing reprisals. Second, with the increasing centrality of the Middle East to U.S. foreign policy, especially since 9/11, being an academic of the Middle East or critical of U.S. actions abroad in the Middle East becomes a poison chalice. It becomes a means to speak truth to power and a means to tether scholars to particular dominant structures of power. Third, the book shows how scholars must learn to navigate long-standing but increasingly intensified political minefields in their academic practice. Minefields that are shaped by academia's sexism and racism and by the university's corporatization. We argue that in this process, many scholars adopt strategies of self-protection, which include self-monitoring and even self-censorship, especially when it comes to criticism of the State of Israel, but also in relation to criticism of U.S. foreign policy or sexism and racism in academia. And finally, this situation has created a general climate of fear that casts a pall over academic analysis and its communication to broader publics, hindering the important work of contributing to an informed U.S. citizenry. After illustrating these issues through the example of research and teaching on Israel-Palestine, I will conclude today's lecture by sharing some preliminary observations on how the politics of academic practice, particularly related to the Middle East, may be on the verge of meaningful change. So to begin, the consummate image of the scholarly life is that it is defined by the free and impassioned pursuit of ideas. Yet all of us working in higher education know that the life on which we once perhaps naively embarked is also filled with politics, much of it quite fraught. Early in graduate school, scholars get their first whiffs of tensions surrounding race, class, gender, and generation, and they learn which topics are open for discussion or research and which are subject to hegemonic silencing. The politics of the job market and tenure are particularly intense in light of shrinking opportunities for tenure-track jobs, as well as high-profile cases of politicized unhiring and tenure denials and battles. The classroom is another site of contested politics, as teachers must delicately manage controversial topics, as well as students' acts of discrimination against each other and against their professors. Committees, faculty meetings, administration and trustee decision-making processes, and the annual meetings of academic associations are also spaces where power is exercised.
Professional associations set the tone and agenda for what counts as legitimate disciplinary practice and concern. And of course, none of these politics are solely generated or contained within the brick and mortar of the academic institution itself. And in the book, we relate many of these issues in academic politics to larger social, economic, and political forces. So our book focuses on the case study of Middle East anthropology in the United States, a relatively small field, but we focus on this because it provides a particularly compelling lens through which to view some of the key stakes in the academy's political struggles as they articulate with broader forces of power. It's especially useful because the Middle East has been the primary geopolitical focus of U.S. foreign policy. Immediately after World War II, the founding of the State of Israel in 1948 sparked a decades-long process of wedding U.S. foreign policy to Israeli state interests. U.S. focus on the region was also fueled by the concomitant scramble to control access to newly discovered oil in the Arab Gulf states. The fall of the Soviet Union essentially coincided with the peak of the First Palestinian Intifada and the first of three major U.S. wars in the region. The end of the Cold War also saw the consolidation of a new canon, initiated two decades earlier, for graduate training in the humanities and social sciences in the U.S. For anthropology as well as other fields, two key tenets of this canon held that the world areas that scholars researched had been set by colonial and Cold War powers, and that scholars could not ignore the subjective and political nature of knowledge production about and representation of so-called others. The politics of doing academic work related to the Middle East grew especially fraught as the region took center stage in U.S. imperial ambitions. On the one hand, over time, we see significantly more interest in funding work on the region and hiring scholars to research and teach about it. Indeed, increased funding streams from the U.S. government and private social research foundations helped to spur the development of Middle East anthropology after World War II. On the other hand, since at least the 1970s, academics who research or teach topics against the grain of dominant U.S. narratives about the region have risked not having their field, their research funded, not being hired, being accused of bias and even treason in their teaching and public lectures, being targeted by blacklists and hate mail, and sometimes losing their jobs. This is especially the case for those who teach about Palestinians or provide critical perspectives on Israeli state actions, as well as for scholars of Arab or Muslim descent who face additional discrimination. Such challenges have intensified in this century with the war on terror. The increase in numbers and reach of right-wing watchdog organizations and the development of internet technologies, which enable greater surveillance and public targeting of scholars. So refracting U.S. academic politics through the lens of anthropology opens up another set of analytic vistas that reveal core tensions within the discipline. So I've already spoken about the Middle East part. Here's the anthropology part and why it's so revealing. The professional practice and demographics of anthropology embody both the post-World War II shift in U.S. domestic politics towards an emphasis on civil rights and the inclusion of female and minority perspectives, as well as the backlash against those shifts and the continued reproduction of structural inequalities and discriminations. Many anthropologists think that their discipline should champion the voices and perspectives of the marginalized, yet some of its practitioners have colluded with colonial and state power. Anthropology has become a heavily feminized discipline since the second wave feminist movement, and it attracts many non-elite scholars, yet it remains largely white, like academia in general. Anthropology is the most resolutely international of the social sciences in its breadth of research sites and privileging of fieldwork done elsewhere. Yet anthropologists based in the U.S. mainly cite their colleagues working in U.S. institutions. And anthropologists frequently identify as politically left-leaning and critical of capitalism, yet continue to work in increasingly corporatized university environments. Meanwhile, when politicians and media pundits characterize universities as bastions of liberalism that do not teach useful skills for economic success, they often point to anthropology as a primary disciplinary example. Thus, our study of Middle East anthropology as practiced in the United States during the apogee of its empire reveals politics of academia in multiple senses of the term politics and at different scales. The result is a complex portrait of how scholarly practice is never pure. It is infused with tensions, large and small. Our book concentrates on the social practice of being a scholar by flipping the ethnographic gaze onto us. It's based on ethnographic interviews with over 100 Middle East anthropologists of different backgrounds, genders, and generations, combined with participant observation in the subfield for over 15 years. We also conducted archival research on academic associations such as the American Anthropological Association, hereafter the AAA, and on right-wing media and external lobbying groups. This cumulative research has not only revealed deep tensions within the academy, but also shows a disciplining, hence our title, disciplining of academics and academic knowledge production, especially as these pertain to the Middle East. Aspects of this disciplining reflect Foucault's analysis of governmentality, as scholars sense the existence of a kind of panoptic power, and at the same time, and often as a result, enter into and create self-regulating, subjectivating processes. This disciplining, though, also includes brute aspects and blunt external agents, as scholars can be subject to public defamation and libel, job denials and losses, and even physical threats or attacks. We show how disciplining emanates from several sources: scholars themselves, students, colleagues, administrators, academic associations, alumni, and outside groups. Such disciplining of both ourselves as scholars and the knowledge we share with students and our other publics is primarily enacted through practices of self-preservation that academics develop in order to navigate the intersections of national, global, and academic politics. And just as a note, we also adopt generation as an analytic to demonstrate how disciplining permeates institutions over time, often through intergenerational advice giving. We can therefore see how disciplining changes in form and tactics in relationship to particular events and forces from the 50s to the 2000s. Both anthropology's core tensions and these processes of internal and external disciplining are especially ignited when it comes to Israel-Palestine. So now I'll turn to that example. So here are some names that are likely familiar to some people in this room: Joseph Massad, Nadia Abulhaj, Norman Finkelstein, Tom Abboud, and now Stephen Salaita. This list signals the potential negative consequences for writing, teaching, and even speaking about the Middle East in the U.S. External community organizations, sometimes working with campus groups, targeted these scholars for taking positions critical of Israeli state policies, being Muslim, Palestinian, or Arab, or being presumed to be, simply asking scholarly questions that call Zionist assumptions into question, or some combination thereof. Most of us have probably heard about some, if not all, of these situations, as they are both the most public examples of what I'll be discussing and the most drastic, situations in which scholars have either lost their livelihoods or been seriously threatened with their loss. Our research instead focuses on the less discussed and stealthier processes and effects of attempts to suppress criticism of the Israeli state and the academy. Most of our interlocutors have not personally experienced such menacing opposition to their tenure or retention that the scholars I named have. But in overwhelming numbers, they still expressed apprehension, a sense that working on the region was a, quote, minefield, and fears that they could easily be targeted because of their teaching, public lectures, or research. One person described this fear as, quote, knowing that people who fall on the wrong side can suffer in their careers, end quote. The fact that levels of apprehension are greater than actual experiences of job denial or loss does not mean that these scholars are imagining things. Less dramatic but pervasive experiences impacted many of their career trajectories. The examples I listed are important not because they are exceptional, but because they represent extreme versions of common experiences. The vast majority of our interlocutors describe multiple encounters across their careers with faculty, colleagues, administrators, and students that strongly suggested to them that they had to adopt, or at minimum adapt to, what scholar Omea Cable has described as compulsory Zionism, following Adrienne Rich's notion of compulsory heterosexuality, a stance that dominates large arenas of the U.S. academy, society, and government. The process of learning about and adapting to these politics begins in graduate school. in relationships with advisors and colleagues, and in the decision about where to locate one's research. We found that even deciding whether or not to work on Palestine was fraught. In the late 70s and early 80s, Palestine was just beginning to appear on students' radars as a potential research site, yet faculty systematically discouraged this choice. One of the pioneering Palestine anthropologists described the struggle to find a PhD advisor willing to work with her. Quote, "They would tell you, no, why would you want to do that? You don't ever want to get a job? Why do you want to do that? I won't work with you." Unquote. Other anthropologists recalled friends or colleagues who had been, quote, punished on the job market for working in Palestine, and people telling each other, quote, "Well, look what happened to so-and-so." As one person put it, working on Palestine was political suicide, asking for trouble. The resilience of those scholars who persevered despite discouragement paved the way for future generations. By the 90s, the discourse of Palestine as a problem for one's career had become common sense among graduate students. Over half of our interlocutors who were trained then noted that, quote, "word on the street during graduate school was that if you worked on Palestine, you would never get a job." In addition, quite a few people were explicitly advised by faculty not to work there to save their careers or to wait until after tenure if they were absolutely compelled to do so. Such warnings sometimes worked. A professor successfully scared one student away from Palestine by telling her that she had to, quote, "be willing to be crucified by Zionists. If you do research in that area, you have to be willing to spend your academic career fighting all the time. Just fighting, you know," unquote. Dangers other than unemployment also loomed large. We found incidents where grant funding was denied, or in one case, withdrawn after being awarded by the National Science Foundation. And at least three of our interlocutors had faculty refuse to serve on their dissertation committees for reasons related to political disagreements on Palestine. Despite these incidences and warnings, the 90s also marked the moment when an increasing number of anthropologists, including several in this room, paid all of this no heed, and they located their research in Palestinian communities. This shift was sparked in part by the start of the first Intifada in 1987, but was mainly facilitated by the U.S.-supported 1993 Oslo Accords and the political opening that normalization, however politically problematic that was, created both for researchers in the field and on U.S. campuses. As one anthropologist explained, after Oslo, quote, "the word Palestine became palatable to people in the U.S. in a new way," end quote, making research more acceptable. There was greater demand for knowledge about Palestine at that time, and it felt like a promising chalice. Nonetheless, graduate students working in the Middle East today are still warned that the chalice might be poisoned. They are told not to take public stances regarding Palestine, and many accept these warnings, as seen, for example, in the fact that most graduate student signatories to the current anthropology petition in support of the boycott of Israeli academic institutions decided to sign anonymously. Others continue to self-censor by waiting until later in their careers to work on Palestine or speak out on those issues. As one explained, quote, and this is actually a person who's just about to get their PhD, quote, "it was like, put that desire to research Palestine away until after you do your dissertation and so on, so that you don't have to deal with all the kinds of issues that people who work in Palestine have to go through," end quote. Students censor both their public stances and their research plans because they fear that any association with a position in support of Palestinian rights will prevent them from getting a job, a fear that is both justified by and out of proportion with the actual cases of academics denied employment or terminated for such positions. Going on the job market, though, is the first real moment of career vulnerability with major stakes. And despite the persistence of fears, we found that job market experiences have varied widely. Of course, reflections upon job searches are refracted through the end results, so it's difficult to pinpoint why certain people don't get jobs. But it is clear that no matter whether Palestine scholars had extreme difficulty getting jobs, which was the case prior to the 1990s, or experienced less difficulty later on, for decades until today, faculty administrators have inserted Israel-Palestine politics into every stage of academic searches in Middle East anthropology. Our interlocutors argued that institutions would rather not hire someone who works on Palestine or who speaks out against Israeli state abuses. Many also believe that pro-Israel anthropologists or administrators have had a negative impact on the hiring of Middle East scholars in general. They base these views on their experience as candidates or later on as search committee members. One senior faculty member, for example, described the job market to us as involving, quote, this little ritual called asking around. So you've made the shortlist. They want to put you on the shortlist. People would ask around. So they ask, what are his politics? You know, that kind of thing. And I did see people being discriminated against for their politics in my department in job searches. Unquote. Sometimes there's no need to ask around when blatant racism will suffice. Another interlocutor told us about a colleague who in the 2000s had systematically opposed all Arab American or Middle Eastern job candidates because, in the colleague's view, quote, they'll have an agenda. That's illegal, by the way, if that wasn't clear. Scholars also told us many stories about this politicization of the job market, stories such as being forewarned about a Zionist search committee member or department chair, being hired only after faculty members who were believed to be hold anti-Palestinian perspectives had left a department, or experiencing pro-Israel questioning at institutions during campus visits. Many were directly interrogated about their personal political views on Israel-Palestine. One person was told by a professor in the late 1980s that he had, quote, heard through the grapevine from a search committee member at another institution that even suggesting to shortlist a person who worked on Palestine was impossible. Others shared stories of learning about, quote, being sunk after a campus visit. In one case, a scholar was told by a search committee member, quote, it's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. They're not going to let you have this job given what you do, unquote. Job talks, the cornerstone of campus visits, often met with hostile audiences and questions irrelevant to the research. I actually should say this hostile questioning about people's personal Israel-Palestine politics on campus visits we found occurred for most Middle East anthropologists, whether or not they actually worked on Israel-Palestine. I experienced it, for example, and I work on Egypt, and certainly not on Israel-Palestine. So, about job talks. In one example, the anthropologist Julie Petit told us how her job talks were followed by questions and arguments unrelated to her research. Questions like, quote, they don't love their children. They send them to kill Israelis. Why do they do that? Or, quote, Israel doesn't engage in any human rights violations, right? Quote. Or, she said, bizarre questions like, when are the Arabs going to come around? She was also asked questions like, quote, do you think if we hire you, we'll have trouble here? Which she noted, quote, are unacceptable professionally as questions, concluding, well, of course you're not going to get a job when people are asking you, are we going to have trouble if we hire you? Quote. Eventually, most of the scholars who shared such stories landed tenure-track jobs, though we were told about others who left academia because they could not. And sometimes after being hired, people heard the backstories about those searches from their new colleagues. In one case, an anthropologist learned that a faculty member outside the department had circulated a politicized memo arguing against her hire to the anthropology department, along with the dean, the provost, and the president of the institution. And he had included with the memo a newsletter from an outside organization describing the Israeli occupation as benign and benevolent. In response to these job market experiences, some scholars who had not done so previously began to self-censor, altering how they presented themselves or their work. For example, a person trained in the 60s who worked in a border region began to emphasize the Turkish aspects of her work over the Arab ones during campus visits. Another who trained in the 80s told us, quote, the fact that I was not getting anywhere in terms of jobs made me stop working on Palestine, start looking at other things. Palestine continued to haunt the job market in the 21st century, even for people whose research had nothing to do with it. Many anthropologists who work elsewhere in the region have had interviewing faculty try to, as one said, suss out their Palestine politics during campus visits, sometimes via point-blank questions. This happened in both formal and informal contexts. For example, an Egypt scholar had a faculty member attempt to engage him in conversation about his personal views on Israel's politics or policies vis-a-vis the Palestinians, despite the fact that his research had nothing to do with that topic. And he asked him these questions in the car on the way to the airport. For many of our interlocutors, these early career experiences contributed to their socialization into the highly politicized field of Middle East anthropology. One of the key lessons they learned in graduate school and on the job market was to put extra effort into protecting themselves. Scholars learned how to steer conversations away from Palestine in professional contexts, meticulously avoided going public with their personal political positions until after tenure, if ever. A recent PhD explained to us that he tends to, quote, self-censor and regulate obsessively. It's something I have to spend 25 hours a day thinking or worrying about in almost all of my interactions, unquote. Another noted that people who don't research Israel-Palestine, quote, don't dare mention it because it's a bomb. As academics, you'll be tied up and crucified if you say the wrong thing, unquote. And another explained that the intense practices of self-monitoring to manage these politics from graduate school onward take a toll on scholars themselves, who learn to, quote, walk around the issue, to negotiate and maneuver so that it almost becomes second nature. So it can appear like all is fine, but to have that tension or anxiety inside when you're dealing with these issues, it really is about self-censorship. We found that later in people's careers, many of the struggles they encounter take place when they refuse or forget to comply with these lessons of self-censorship. Thus, we see the persistence of both an atmosphere of fear and apprehension and the resulting strategies that scholars use to navigate it. They've been socialized into these strategies. After academics get the job, so to speak, the classroom becomes a key site of politicized struggle. This part's for you undergrads in the room. The classroom. Student surveillance of professors' teaching and other campus activities, as well as complaints from students and parents about these professors, echo similar tactics from the McCarthy and Vietnam eras. Over the decades, our interlocutors have experienced a range of student and external organization tactics, including recording classes without permission, walking out of class, sending threatening emails to professors, complaining to administrators, interrupting classes in a hostile manner, and on occasion, threatening professors' physical safety. A scholar's gender, race, ethnicity, or religion often affected these classroom dynamics. Those whose students accused of being anti-Semitic were, in almost every case, people who were read as Arab or Muslim by those students. And at all career stages, female scholars were way more likely to describe political attacks on their teaching than were male scholars. For example, senior Arab American anthropologist Lauren Nader has written about teaching Julie Petit's first book on women in the Palestinian resistance movement in a large introduction anthropology course in the early 90s at UC Berkeley, an institution with a strong pro-Israel student activism trend that is coordinated with Bay Area Zionist organizations. She wrote, quote, "Parents came asking why Palestinians were being humanized when they were terrorists, while insinuating that as a result, the class had an anti-Semitic outlook," end quote. Some department chairs have even warned anthropologists not to teach about Palestine at all. One scholar was told that he, quote, "might want to avoid the Palestinian issue on his syllabi because you don't want to have your ass being the first one hung out the window," end quote. This is exactly what happened to Mizrahi Israeli anthropologist Smadar Levi when she taught a class called Ethnographies of Palestine and Israel at UC Davis in 1993, just before she submitted her tenure file. So you can imagine the stress. Davis, along with Berkeley and other schools in Northern California, actually, was the target of an academic blacklist dating back to the early 80s. In 93, a group of students, encouraged by the Hillel rabbi, organized a series of personalized attacks on Levi and her teaching. Written testimony from one of the course's TAs states, quote, "There has been a deliberate attempt to undermine Professor Levy's professorial authority in the class. Talking with students after their first review session revealed that several individuals connected with the Hillel House approached students after class, denouncing it as anti-Semitic." These attempts to undermine the class included, as recorded in the testimony of an enrolled student, and all these testimonies were in a file as part of the university investigation, the attempts included disrupting Levi's lectures and arguing with her destructively by distorting her arguments. And the testimony also noted that students had organized a phone tree to coordinate actions against Levi, and frequently met after class to discuss, quote, how she had a chip on her shoulder because she was Mizrahi and therefore wanted to make Israel look bad, and she's a self-hating Jew, end quote. The testimony's author also reported overhearing another student say, quote, I'll see to it that she gets fired. I have my connections. He also later said, we found in the documents, that he was going to have her face smashed into the ground. According to multiple reports, the Hillel rabbi told people not to participate in Levi's assignment to interview an Israeli and a Palestinian. This made it difficult for students to complete coursework. Students also disparaged one of the TAs, who they claimed was incapable of grading fairly due to having a Middle Eastern background. Levi eventually got tenure, but her class reflects an extreme version of common experiences. While the events of 9/11 led to new student interest in the region, an example of the chalice's positive side, they also led to an appreciable worsening of this teaching climate, such that over half of our interlocutors experienced the chalice's poison in the classroom after 9/11. Today, there's even an app for that called Combat Hate You, which encourages students to, quote, see it, report it, immediately using their smartphones. And the app is asking students to report anti-Semitism, but when you look at discussions on its associated Twitter feed, it indicates that this includes anything and everything perceived to be critical of Israel, therefore creating a slippage between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. The worsening of the teaching climate, especially in the first few years after 9/11, took a particular toll on scholars assumed to be Muslim or Arab. One such scholar had a group of Hillel students gather 50 signatures from people she didn't know on a petition stating that since she was hired, quote, there was an anti-Semitic sentiment on campus, unquote. When she went and complained to the administration, she learned that it was one of her colleagues who had been running around and saying she was anti-Semitic. Several years later, a student activist with the radical pro-Israel group Stand With Us posted a video on YouTube attacking this professor, reiterating those allegations and falsely claiming that the professor had been reprimanded and denied the right to teach about the Middle East. In another case, a student informed an Arab American instructor on the very first day of class and with significant hostility that she had looked her up. During that same class, a parent called the anthropologist and told her that she was really worried when she found out that an Arab would be teaching her daughter. Another Arab American scholar had parents accuse her in two different classes of not grading fairly because she, quote, must hate Jews. Other anthropologists had students record classes without permission. In one case, students then wrote an article in the campus newspaper linking the professor to Hamas on the flimsy basis of his Arab ethnicity. And yet another was accused by a campus rabbi of teaching anti-Semitic material. In this case, award-winning author Joe Sacco's work of graphic journalism titled Palestine. So experiencing, or even just hearing, about episodes like these have made Middle East anthropologists far more wary about teaching about Palestine-Israel than about Islam or other regional conflicts and wars. One junior scholar declared to us, quote, I simply will not teach a class about Israel and Palestine. I just won't do it. It's not worth the trouble. A tenured scholar who regularly teaches about Iraq and Afghanistan says, quote, I have a clear sense that when it comes to Israel-Palestine, you watch out. You make sure you don't say things that will get you into trouble. I only monitor myself in that one issue, which I think everybody has to do, end quote. Faculty who did venture to teach this material often carefully honed additional strategies to avoid problems. These included addressing issues in historical rather than contemporary terms, or presenting quantitative data like numbers of deaths on each side and allowing the students to notice the differences themselves. Some also limited their teaching of the subject to seminars with large workloads to encourage students who are registered as moles to drop the class. They also perfected a non-confrontational classroom style, consistently saying things like, it's a major tragedy for both peoples, or starting the class by deconstructing concepts like balance and objectivity to preempt criticism, often using the wonderful work of our colleague, Professor Nabashar. Another scholar who was not reluctant to teach about Palestine said he nonetheless, he feels the experience is like, quote, treading on eggshells. There is no doubt that these fears are partly the result of the intensification of organized campaigns on multiple campuses to monitor, harass, and attack scholars, critical of Israeli state policies and U.S. support of them. Frequently, these campaigns link pro-Israel student activists to local or national groups like the David Project, the Endowment for Middle East Understanding, the AMCOT Initiative, and Campus Watch, and also Stand With Us, which I understand was actually around today when for one Israeli Apartheid Week event. And as we've seen recently with the Stephen Salaita case, sometimes administrators take these groups' accusations more seriously than the principle of academic freedom. They do so in part because of pressure to their bottom line, a pressure that is also intensified in this neoliberal era of decreased government funds for education. These organizations do more than just monitor faculty, however. They galvanize and coordinate hostile responses to scholars' public lectures. They initiate public blacklists of scholars, and they write and circulate slanderous portrayals of scholars on the internet. With very few exceptions, Middle East anthropologists of all backgrounds thought that external intervention, while neither new nor unprecedented, was more frequent and intense in the 21st century due to the war on terror and new media technologies enabling these various campaigns against faculty. This century also brought the Second Palestinian Intifada into headlines and classroom discussions. It seems that off-campus organizations have been simultaneously empowered by the internet and also threatened by the more openly critical discussions of the Israeli state emerging on campuses after the series of brutal attacks on Gaza, most recently in the summer of 2014, that they're also learning about through the internet. Public lectures have also been a flashpoint for attack. Hopefully this one will not be. As one person explained, quote, all of us have the experience of dealing with aggressive audiences, aggressive questioning from audiences, questions that are off topic, like where the Palestinians should be relocated, when I'm trying to make a point about Foucault, unquote. While sometimes audience members were hostile to lectures on Islam in general or to criticism of U.S. foreign policy, again, the vast majority of these confrontations following lectures that include criticism of the Israeli state. But sometimes just presenting research on Palestinians that presented them as human beings was enough to provoke accusations of bias. Antagonistic audiences are sometimes very well prepared by off-campus Israel advocacy groups. When Laura D., my co-author, was scheduled to lecture about the Lebanese political party Hezbollah at Rice University a few years ago, her host called to warn her about a newspaper article that called for, quote, at least 101 individuals who are concerned about Israel to attend and ask the pertinent questions, unquote. And indeed, many members of the packed audience referred to printed pieces of paper while asking questions. In other words, they held a list of questions that had been produced and distributed to them before she gave her lecture. So it stacked the Q&A with anti-Palestinian perspectives for a lecture that actually was not about Israel-Palestine, interspersed with outbursts. Many anthropologists told us that they received nasty or threatening emails after episodes like this one, as Laura did. And a few people described situations of seriously escalated hostility and threatening physical encounters. There have been occasions when security has had to intervene after these lectures to protect the speaker. Although many colleagues told us they accepted verbally aggressive audiences as par for the course, a few noted, often to their own dismay, that they had decided to give fewer lectures or avoid speaking about politicized issues as a result, again disciplining themselves. Many also explain that they steel themselves before lectures and prepare answers to typical hostile questions, which are often unrelated to their research presentations. Even anthropologists whose lectures had nothing to do with Israel-Palestine, not even about Hezbollah, which is related to Israel-Palestine in some way, sometimes encountered hostility from audience members who saw any discussion about Arabs as inherently problematic. An Egypt scholar explained it this way, quote, Palestine is the flashpoint. It's the slope that you're fighting uphill against. The frame is that Arabs are terrorists, barbaric, and uncivilized. And the Israeli-Palestinian conflict has a lot to do with the production of that discourse. And we have to know that our audience is already inundated with that. Unquote. The recent proliferation of online blacklists provide direction for public lecture attendees, as well as for student campaigns to monitor or harass faculty. They can also foment massive public pressure on institutions, calling on them to rein in or even fire particular scholars. In the early 2000s, for example, an organization called the American Council of Trustees and Alumni, so it's a council of trustees and alumni, so they have tremendous power to threaten institutional donor bases, released a report that lists 117 academics who supposedly threaten national security. Websites like Campus Watch also started targeting faculty deemed to be unpatriotic and complicit with terrorism, initially publishing, as many of you will remember, dossiers on individual academics. It became a mark of pride to be on Campus Watch, actually. In 2006, David Horowitz, whose so-called Freedom Center includes the watchdog sites Front Page Magazine and Discover the Networks, published a book called The Professors, 101 Most Dangerous Academics in America. Most recently, a group called AMCA, that claims to protect Jewish students from anti-Semitism, again conflated with criticism of the Israeli state, produced a blacklist of 200 scholars, 25% of whom are anthropologists, mostly, though not all, specializing in the Middle East. External organizations sometimes demand that institutions fire faculty. This happened to one anthropologist simply because she organized an Arabic language film series and is married to an Arab, who was accused of being a member of Hamas, of course. Even non-Middle East anthropologists are not immune. For instance, when Daniel Siegel advocated for a Palestinian student who was verbally assaulted by an Israeli professor during a political event, the student was called a cockroach. The Zionist Organization of America wrote to Siegel's college president, demanding, among other things, that he be fired. Most concerning to many academics are the threats to personal safety, which date back at least to the 1970s. And I can say when I presented this talk at the University of California, Los Angeles, and when I read that about the threats to personal safety in the 1970s, one faculty member burst into tears in remembering those days. Accusations of being anti-Semitic or a self-hating Jew carried particular emotional weight for some of our interlocutors. Anthropologists who had been activists against anti-Semitism during their careers pointed to the painful irony of these accusations, as well as to the tragedy that long histories of activism could be so readily erased. This sort of defamation also ignored anthropology's historically ahead of the time stance against anti-Semitism. One academic who was blacklisted in the early 80s for allegedly being an anti-Semite told us, quote, "As a cultural anthropologist in the tradition of Franz Boas, I find anti-Semitism to be a form of prejudice that I strongly condemn," unquote. When colleagues brought charges against Lisa Rofel, an anthropologist of China, after she organized an academic conference called Rethinking Zionism, she was particularly appalled that they tried to apply their interpretation of a 2004 revision regarding anti-Semitism to the Title VI Act to her case. The colleagues spearheading the attack against Rofel interpreted this revision as both adding Jews to the previously protected categories of race, color, or national origin, and defining anti-Semitism to include anti-Israel or anti-Zionist activities. Rofel told us, quote, "It upset me on so many levels, but one level is, and this I even learned from my mother, who's not radical on these issues, but because of the Holocaust, my mother and others of her generation are adamant that Judaism is not a race. So to reinscribe that into civil rights legislation is really disturbing," unquote. While some people brushed off these stresses and emotional tolls, others chose to step back from the spotlight, essentially relearning the lesson of self-censorship. Whether this meant rejecting speaking invitations or foregoing leadership opportunities related to programming at their institutions, for example, leading a Middle East center. In circumstances like these, it is no surprise that many Middle East anthropologists prefer to avoid teaching or speaking about hot-button issues, even as their various publics seem to want to know more about the region. So let me conclude. Our book demonstrates that there is a strong pattern of self-monitoring and self-censorship around Middle East U.S. politics, and Palestine-Israel in particular, that goes back decades in U.S. academia. It results from racialized and gendered academic socialization, intertwined with pressures from colleagues, students, administrators, and outside interest groups. This pattern is particularly worrying because our interlocutors are anthropologists who have focused their research on the Middle East and sometimes in Palestinian communities. Their scholarly expertise should position them to share this knowledge. And indeed, they are frequently offered the chalice to speak and to teach. But because it is poisoned by the dynamics I've just described, they are scared to speak. What then of colleagues who want to include a unit on Israel-Palestine in a course on settler colonialism, or on gender and militarism, or in any of the myriad topical courses that might benefit from including material related to Israel-Palestine? The politicized structure of academia, shaped as it is by U.S. and international politics, produces this dynamic. Everything we've detailed here is at odds with the principles of academic freedom, the advancement of scholarship, and the critical pedagogies that our colleges and universities often claim to promote. Yet perhaps this dismal story is on the verge of change. The Salaita affair has shown many non-Middle East scholars just how toxic the mixture of politics, donor money, external organizations, and neoliberal administrators can be. This is no longer just a story of Middle East scholars or anthropologists, if it ever really was. Across fields, scholars' senses of ethical responsibility are pushing more and more of them to teach or speak about Israel-Palestine despite the potential consequences. Many of our interlocutors shared an assumption that anthropologists actually have an ethical obligation to communicate the perspectives of people in places where we conduct research, and relatedly to advocate for social justice. We've also seen shifts in public discourse, including the U.S. public turn against the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and a growing national conversation critical of U.S. and Israeli state policies and actions that contravene international law and human rights norms. And there's a growing academic conversation in which a critical mass of scholars are speaking back to organized efforts to constrain their speech. A scholar trained in the 2000s gave us a sense of how the decades-long struggle of Middle East scholars has finally begun to have an impact, as a generation of junior scholars is simultaneously more supported and less fearful. He told us, quote, "In college, right after 9/11, someone found out I was Palestinian and turned to me and said, 'Oh, I never knew there was affirmative action for terrorists.' And I was silent at that moment, and I had vowed that I would not be silent again." And finally, as most of you probably know, just a few weeks ago at the anthropology meetings, a few months ago at the anthropology meetings at Denver, over 1,000 anthropologists voted for a resolution calling on the AAA to endorse the boycott of Israeli academic institutions that are complicit in the occupation of Palestine and actively discriminate against Palestinian citizens of Israel. The voices speaking publicly in support of the boycott over the past 3 years have included many junior scholars and graduate students. This appears to be a major sea change in both anthropology and the academy at large. Perhaps in the near future, the chalice that Middle East anthropologists and Middle East scholars more broadly hold will not be quite so poisonous. Thank you.
You have been listening to Northwestern University anthropologist Jessica Winiger speaking on her book, Anthropology's Politics, Disciplining the Middle East. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday when we will feature Allison Weir, founder and director of the organization If Americans Knew, speaking in Natick, Massachusetts. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.